several men help me, that would be nice. Walk is seated. We can all stand now, please. Actually, if you have your notes, let's start in your notes at the top of your notes. I don't know how you read the Bible. I assume you try to actually pay attention to literary features. If you're reading chapter 14 of 1 Samuel, something you should find rather weird. And they're the first verses in your notes. There's a little Hebrew there because I just wanted to demonstrate it's the exact same Hebrew phrase in both places. Verse 23 is the conclusion to the first story in chapter 14. So the Lord saved Israel that day. Bayom. What's weird is in the very next verse, and the men of Israel were distressed. What? That day. Now that's weird, because in this chapter 14, you have two big stories. We're going to deal with one tonight. We'll deal with one either next Sunday morning or next Sunday night, according to my mood. Chapter 14, after this story, of course, gets into the subject of Saul's weirdness. Remember the rest of the story? He got an oath, put people under a curse, didn't let them eat. It's a strange story. So when you read this, the two big stories are their victory. God gives a great victory. And they come in great distress. And it all happens the same day. So you got to understand, sometimes in your own life, you will experience conflicting emotions the same day. Victory, defeat, or success and weirdness. And that's what we have. Chapter 14 and verse 1. Now it came to pass upon that day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over to the Philistines, or the Philistines' garrison, that is on the other side. By the way, the next line in literature is called an aside. Do you understand what that means? Look here, I'm telling you a story, and then it's like, take a breath. By the way, he didn't tell his father. You should pay attention to that. That's a major portion of this story. I think we read the Bible like we read books in first grade. You ever hear a first grader read a book? Flat. These are stories meant to be read, meant to be understood. Verse 2. Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people that were with him were about 600 men. And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother. Good guy or bad guy? See, if you don't know the Bible, you're sitting there, see, you just walk right past this. The son of Phinehas, the son of whom? What condition was this family in? Under what? Yes, God had cursed his family. He's going to destroy this family. Guess who Saul's priest was? Then there's another little aside. Oh, by the way, the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side, and the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sina. And you can read all that. Verse 6, I preached on last Sunday morning, and Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, come, and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. But there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And that to me is just wonderful, for there is no restraint. And his armor bearer said unto him, do all that is in thine hand, or heart. Turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. We're going to read the rest of this in the sermon. I said this morning when I began preaching that I was going to preach short. So tonight I'm going to preach short. Okay, we're going to hurry. I'm not in a hurry, but I just want to summarize this section, and I want to preach on the subject of against all odds, because God saves his people that day, and it sure wasn't because of the leadership, and it sure wasn't because of the nonsense going on. Let me just say this before we pray interceded. My goal tonight is one simple goal. Some of us think the only way God can do anything in America is if everything is perfect. God is just not limited by our stupid. And we are stupid. We're stupid as people. We're sinful. It is amazing to me the depths of our depravity in this country. What we tolerate, what we accept, what we smile about. Yet God is not limited against all odds. Let's pray. Our Father, I thank you for this day. Thank you that you can help us look at this great text and see the ingredients, so to speak, in this great victory. The victory over the Philistines, at least at this point in time. Bless your word to us. Help us to hear. Help us to understand who you are. Kind of referring back to this morning. This we ask in Christ's name. Amen. You may be seated. We like success stories. We like to win, and frankly, we like winners. We can remember the losers. Frenchie is still, remember, he has a trophy in his house of Bill Buckner. He's still depressed from Bill Buckner way back in the dark ages losing, and the Red Sox losing the World Series. But we prefer winners. Right before I came here, or 5:30 or so tonight, I got online and checked my email. I don't know why. I never do, but I did tonight. And my good friend Pastor Allen sent me an email. And it was an email that Pastor Kowak, I know, is going to be happy to hear. I'm not giving anything away about your game, Pastor Kowak. But he said, what was it? Something about choking or something. And, of course, the 49ers choked again today. By the way, do we like losers? How many times has the 49ers choked? Does anybody know? Some of you don't watch football. Many times, many times. We like winners. We like people to win. Even I, which am not a football fan, I enjoyed watching a month or so back when Green Bay was not playing a particularly good game and it comes down to the last seconds and I mean, and you know, Aaron Rodgers runs and throws a ball farther than I can see. And somehow everybody's in the end zone and a guy along the side runs up, jumps in front of everybody, catches the ball, wins the game. It was pretty exciting. Now, of course, all the Green Bay cheeseheads don't want to talk to you about last week when they tried that again and it didn't work. We like winners, don't we? We like to win. That's the nature of who we are. We like to see things in this text is about winning, and it's about winning against all odds. So I want to encourage you that God is not limited to our weaknesses. So in your notes, Israel wins against all odds. First of all, they win against numerical superiority, no question. Numerical superiority. 1 Samuel 13 talks about the size of the Philistine army. I will not get into the details of it other than to say it was a massive army compared to what Israel had. If Israel had a few thousand, I mean 2,000 with Saul, 1,000 with Jonathan, that's a small group of people. The Philistines had a pretty massive army going to attack. So, but look at me, somehow they win. You say, how does that happen? Sometimes God lets it happen. I don't know if you've ever read the book. I would recommend it. If you like history at all, David McCullough wrote a book called 1776. It's really just a book just about the beginning of the war and just about President Washington's crossing of the Delaware, escaping from the British. And even David McCullough, and I don't know that he's a Christian, said something to this effect. He called it providence because fog came in. Allowed President Washington, it wasn't President at the time, General Washington to escape. Then they crossed the Delaware in the ice. They defeated the Hessians, I mean, almost without even a fight. Yes, against numerical superiority. Next in your notes. Certainly also, they won against strategic superiority. The strategy of the Philistines was so much better than the Jews in this case. Jewish people had no strategy at all. Saul's strategy was to run away, hide in holes, get as far away from the enemy as he can. The Philistines, and you have it in your notes, the Philistine strategy, and I'm not going to explain it all, but if you look at this on a map, what they did was they sent people in three directions and then a fourth direction. They split the country up, so a bunch of the Jewish military couldn't get to the other Jewish military. They were kind of separated off. The Philistines not only had a numerical superiority, they had a strategic superiority. They should have easily won this battle. Number three. We've talked about this before. There was also, they won against technological superiority. We're going to read this. It's not very clear. Friend, please look at me for just a moment. History is written after the fact. And after the fact, by the way, during the Revolutionary War, nobody knew how long it was going to last. Nobody thought America was going to win. But after the fact, we look back and say, oh yeah, we won, and it was from here to here. We didn't know that. History is written after the fact. What you have here is something written during the period of time describing something that people in the modern world call the end of the Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age. But they're describing it during the time, not as you look back. And now we say, oh yeah, the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Assyrians, and the people, the Philistines, which were probably from many of them from Greece, they were well-armed, well, and they had modern technology. Some of it doesn't even hardly make sense. Look with me, if you would. 1 Samuel 13. Now, there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make themselves swords and spears. By the way, anybody could make a sword and a spear for 800 years before that in bronze. It's talking about Iron Age tools. There was not a smith, someone that knew how to smelt iron. And I've said this before, you can read it in your own things. The moment certain countries had iron, it's like the United States and most countries' military. It doesn't look good. And once somebody gets a nuclear bombs like we have, it's just overwhelming. Well, in this day and age, the Jewish people didn't have Iron Age instruments. In your notes, I'll just give you this. Down under the Philistines were in the early Iron Age. Israel was in the late Bronze Age, meaning there was an overlap. The poorer countries, the mountain, these people were up in the mountains, the Jewish people were. They didn't have much access to technology. So any kind of technology they had to come out of the mountains, down along the seacoast, down to the Philistines, and the Philistines would sharpen whatever things they had, but they wouldn't give away their technology. Their technology was their superiority. So we find in this passage the Jewish people winning against numerical superiority, strategic superiority, and technological superiority. The Jews are in a bad shape. Number four. Now I'm going to change the word to with. Read the verses with me. But he told not his father. Who was the leader of the military at the time? Saul and who? Saul and who? Jonathan. Saul ran two-thirds of the military. Jonathan ran one-third. What would you think if Pastor Koch did something and didn't tell me? What do you call that? You got a problem, don't you? Folks, you got problems. You have problems because Saul's basic tactic towards the Philistines is run and hide. Let's go under some tree someplace and let's talk it to death. Let's discuss it to death. You have in your notes, they won a great victory with divided leadership. There is no question that Jonathan and his dad had different views about how to do things. One man said this, and by the way, I'll let you, as you read through 1 Samuel. He says when you read through 1 Samuel, you realize Israel got it all wrong. If they would have waited 5 minutes, not only could they have had David, they could have had Jonathan as the king. But they got Saul, the bonehead. Mm-hmm. So, verse 3. And Ahiah, the son of Hittub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod, and the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. And in verse 17, when all of this battle is going on and there's all this stuff going on, the only thing that our wonderful Saul wanted to know is who's gone. Saul's an interesting character. Then said Saul unto the people that were with him, number now and see who is gone from us. So you have divided leadership. It's very difficult to get things done with divided leadership. The most important thing a pastor does when he comes to an organization is try to get leaders going the same direction he is. In case you don't know, that's the number one thing I tried to do here. And after a point, I tried to get people in the offices. I still haven't accomplished getting people in the offices that follow me. Lois does, but the other one, not so much. But you have people that you can work with. You don't want to have divided leadership. One person going this way and one going this way. But somehow, through all of this, numerical superiority, strategic superiority, technological superiority, and even the divided leadership, God wins through this mess. And it is a mess. Next, in your notes, with spiritual confusion. Right in the midst of all of this, there's not much godliness going on. It is a spiritual mess. Look at verse 3. We have already read this. And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. So I'm going to ask you a question. Is this the guy you would have in charge of anything? This is Eli's kid. What? We continue. Verse 18. And Saul said unto Ahiah, bring hither the ark of God, for the ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel. Verse 19. And it came to pass, when Saul talked unto the priest, that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased. And Saul said unto the priest, withdraw thy hands. Now turn your page. We're going to come back to that in a moment. Turn your page to the next page. Here's what I don't know. It is difficult to know exactly what Saul knew and believed. Here are some statements and some questions. We know this. The first thing is a statement. We know he did not know who Saul, Saul didn't know who Samuel was. By the way, that's like living in Chicago in the 1980s and 90s and not knowing who Michael Jordan was. That is impossible. You say, I don't like basketball. Makes no difference. Saul lived right down the road from him and didn't know who Samuel was. We know that for sure. So what kind of a person was Saul? When I was a young man, John R. Rice, I'd read his books. He tried to prove that Saul was saved. And on every page of 1 Samuel, it's telling you he was never a believer. He had nothing to do with anything. And the only kind of religion he wanted was Eli's children and grandchildren? Wow. Next. I asked the question, did he know about Eli and family? How could he not know about Eli and family? Please look at me. What happened to Eli? Raise your hand. What happened to Eli? He was very kabod. He was full of glory. He was very heavy, fell off backwards and broke his neck. What happened? By the way, the whole family was killed. Did Saul not know? May I ask you a question? What did Saul know? But we don't know if it's know or believe. Next. I asked the question, did he know Deuteronomy 20? And you'll have to turn to the previous page to read Deuteronomy 20 with me, please. Deuteronomy 20 is one of those commands that it seems like Saul maybe knew. It says in Deuteronomy 20, when thou goest out to battle against thine enemies, and seest horses and chariots and a people more than thou. Was this that occasion? Were there more people than them? Yes. Horses? Yes. Yes. He says, be not afraid of them, for the Lord thy God is with thee, when that which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Verse 2, and it shall be, when you shall come nigh unto the battle, that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people, and shall say unto them, hear, O Israel, you approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint. Fear not, and do not tremble, neither be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. And by the way, in the end of this story, it is the Lord that saves his people, not Saul, not the army, the Lord. So you have some serious spiritual confusion. Did he know about Eli and Eli's family? Did he know about Deuteronomy 20? Next in your notes. Or did he use the priests, the ark, and the accoutrements that went along with this? Look at me, please. For magical purposes? To get God on his side? You know, let me pray a prayer. Let me light a candle. Let me do this. Let me do Baptist speak. Let me do some religion that maybe God get. I personally think Saul basically liked, like a lot of people do, Tuesday, I think our wonderful president's going to give his final speech. Is that correct? Please look me in the eyes. At the end of that speech, what will he say? God bless America. And exactly what does that mean? Nothing. Saul was one of those kind of guys. I think he used priests, the rituals, whatever else they did. From my perspective, kind of like we use magic. He was a practicer of kulam, Dada, in his manku kulam in the nursery, right? I'll tell her when we go to eat later. A practicer of witchcraft, that's what it was. In your notes, another question I have is, why did he stop? The whole idea was to bring the priest. The priest was to pray. Maybe the priest was to use some of the things that the Old Testament gave priests to use. Maybe. But I don't know, because this was not Samuel and his sons. This was Eli and remnants of Eli that had been rejected. But the priests were supposed to pray and then speak to the military. But right in the middle of all this, you know what it says. Look on the previous page. If you look on the previous page in verse 19, he says, stop, withdraw thy hand. Let's stop this. So here is the first portion of this sermon. Against all odds, Israel won. Against numerical superiority, strategic superiority, technological superiority, with divided leadership, with spiritual confusion, number six, and with some very unlikely resources or help. They did have some people helping them. 1 Samuel 14, 21 and 22 tells us who helped the Jewish people win this battle. It said, moreover, the Hebrews, which is normally reserved for God's enemies and the people of God's enemies, normally they call the Jewish people Hebrews, but in this text, the author is calling them that, which is strange. Normally in 1 Samuel, it's the enemies using that as a put down. In this passage, the author is using it probably as a put down. It says, moreover, the Hebrews that were with the what? I want to ask you a question. What do you call people that convert with the enemy? No, you don't. You bring them home and send five criminals back over to, yes, I'm sorry, we're talking about the Bible. Yes, you call them traitors, friend. So the Hebrews that had been with the Philistines before that time, which went up with them into the camp from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. Verse 22. Likewise, all the men of Israel which had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, even they also followed hard after them into the battle or in the battle. I want to ask everyone a question. Have you ever met a person that's been in America a long time and would ever tell you this? My family fought in the Revolutionary War for the British. Sparky, were there lots of people that fought for the British or at least supported the British? You notice an American man, hey, I am a daughter. You get people, I'm a daughter or a son of the Revolution. Isn't that what they call them, daughter of the Revolution? But I have never met a person that said, yes, my family did fight in the Revolutionary War for the British. So here's the people who's going to help the Jews win the battle. In your notes, maximally they were traitors. Isn't this Bergdahl? I mean, I know I've heard his story. You know, one morning I woke up, I was having a bad night, I wandered out into the desert. I thought I was Jason Bourne. No joke, the guy said this. that I could somehow escape. Are you kidding me? I've even heard some liberals say, well, you know, being with the Taliban or whoever he was with for 5 years, that's enough punishment. I thought that was, he was a traitor. Minimally, these people were traitors, yes? They joined the Philistines until they thought, oh, the Philistines might lose. Maybe we'll join the Jews now. Next. Maximally traitors, minimally they were mercenaries. And when I say mercenary, I don't mean just someone that sells their service. I mean someone that's always doing this. Which side's going to win? Testing the air. Minimally, both of these groups were mercenary in that when they saw, they thought Saul and Jonathan were going to win. I think we're going to get on Saul and Jonathan's side. Next. Plus. So here's one group that joined them, either traitors or mercenaries, and the other group were cowards. They were the people hiding in holes. Isn't that the kind of people? Let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard somebody that says, my family fought in the Civil War, and after the first battle, they were cowards and they went back home? Do you know how many hundreds of thousands of people fought in battles and didn't even get to the first battle and went back home? By the way, so here's Israel's army, cowards and traitors, and both of them are mercenaries, meaning both groups, look at me, are watching. And when the Philistines are winning, one group's hiding and one group is being a traitor. And the moment the Jewish people start winning, both groups say, I think we better join Saul's side. Well, you wonder how in the world God could ever win a battle. Can I say something to you? Aren't you glad God is not limited to us? Aren't you glad God's not limited to our limitations? So on one side, you have all the superiority of the Philistines. Numerical, technological, strategic. On the other side, you have spiritual confusion. You have divided leadership. And you have some help from cowards and traitors. I change the preposition again. I'm going to let you read this with me, and I'll give you the idea. And probably some of you know the word. 1 Samuel 14 is how God finally, really, in a big way, wins the victory. It says, and there was a trembling in the host, meaning of the Philistines, in the field and among all the people and the garrison and the spoilers. They also trembled, and the earth quaked. So it was a very great trembling. And the watchmen of Saul of Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude of the Philistine army melted away, and they went on beating down one another. What do you call this, friend? I'll use David McCullough's word in a biblical word. We find the Jewish people winning against all odds, number 7, by providential events and circumstances. When you look at this, if I was an observer looking at this military, I'd think to myself, you have got to be kidding me. There's 3,000 people total. Saul only had 600. I guess the rest of them were hiding in holes someplace. A bunch of the Hebrew people had gone over. They have no technological ability. They have no strategic ability. They don't have the numbers. He's looking at, how are these Jewish believers going to win? But you forget something. There's a God. And that God isn't limited to you or me. And just because, well, I don't have the latest equipment. Friend, we're a church. We're a small church in Waukegan. We're trying to reach people here. We're trying to reach people abroad. We're trying to help people. If I look at us, I'm sorry. Some of us are pretty miserable. And I think to myself, there is no hope that we could ever do anything. And God just smiles when you can't do anything. God laughs at that kind of foolishness. Because out of whatever God has, God can providentially do what he wants to do. So he sends a little earthquake thing. You ever heard of it? By the way, you did notice the earthquake was just where the Philistines were. That's not providential, though. That's a total accident of history. Okay. We continue. Verse 20. And Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to battle. Behold, every man's sword was against his fellow. When they got there, they didn't even have to do much of the fighting. The Philistines, because of this earthquake and because of God's providential work, caused the Philistines to basically fight themselves. And there was a great, boy, I love that kind of language. Don't you like words like that in the King James? How about this? They got whooped. How's that sound? Psalm 103, verse 19. Folks, these are verses that are precious. The Lord hath prepared his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom ruleth over all. Psalm 115, verse 3. But our God is in the heaven. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. Psalm 135, verse 5. For I know that the Lord is great, and that our Lord is above all gods. Whatsoever the Lord pleased, that did he in heaven and in earth, in the seas, and in all deep places. Psalm 75, 6. For promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south, but God is the judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another. Everyone look at me. We're going to go to the last point. We're going to get done by 7 o'clock unless I talk too long right now. If you would have told me 2 years ago that Hillary Clinton would not be in prison, I wouldn't be surprised. Because our country, for the last 30 years, has been a country of criminals. Like it or not like it, laws don't mean much at that level. My best friend said this. Do you remember when certain companies in America, this is what was said, they're too big to fail? Kerry told me, and I think Kerry's right, we think Hillary's too big to jail. But hold on. Could you have believed 3 or 4 years ago that Donald Trump would be the front runner of anything? I'm going to be honest with you. I have no hope. I'm looking around and I'm like, Trump or Hillary? I really do want to leave this country if that's my choice. It's the Antichrist or the Antichrist brother. It's like, really? My friend, the only reason I don't lose hope is God is just not limited to our stupid. And boy, that's the only hope I have. Our God is bigger than that. Now, I'm going to finish the sermon in your chair. How was this battle won? Against all odds, they won. By the way, Philistines had a massive armory, numerical superiority. They had technological superiority. They had iron weapons compared to bronze weapons. They had strategic. They actually had a strategy. Saul's strategy was run away and hide. Not only that, Jonathan wanted to do something. Saul wanted to hide. Not only that, Saul, I don't know what his spiritual thinking was, but it never makes sense to me. And when the smoke clears, how is God going to do something? Providentially, God's going to do some things like send a little earthquake right smack dab in the middle of the camp, not where the Jewish people are, just where the Philistines are. And they get so discombobulated and so confused, they start fighting each other. God is capable. But it all comes down, humanly speaking, to this, by godly initiative. You know what mean godly initiative is? I want everyone to look at me. If I mention names, people would be offended. I have started to notice there's people in this room that cannot ever, ever, ever take initiative in any area. I preach my heart out, they just sit back down and turn TV on. I have begged people for 2 weeks on Sunday morning. I have preached my heart out. By the way, you know what God uses? God uses a guy named Jonathan that said, well, let's read what it says. You don't mind, do you? Old Jonathan says in verse 1, come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison. Come on, let's do it. You know what God never uses? Dead-headed people. Let's go back to sleep. Verse 6. Jonathan again says, come and let us go over into the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there's no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. Chapter 14, verse 11. And both of them discovered or showed themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistine says, behold the Hebrews. Remember I said normally Hebrews is what they are called. Slander. The Hebrews come forth out of the holes where they have hid themselves. And the men of the garrisons answered Jonathan, his armor bearer, and said, hey, come up to us and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said unto his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up upon him. I love this. This is godly initiative. Please look at me. We're going to read this in a moment. You got issues? Look at me. You got a Sunday school class? You got an Awana you're working at? Talk to Jim tonight. I'm going to say it directly to you. There's people here that in Awana are asleep on a good night. And the kids recognize what you're doing. When you walk around in life like this, all it takes is one person to make a difference. You say, how is it going to work out? Who cares? Grab a hold of it. Come on, let's move forward. Instead of this, do you see yourself? Do you ever watch yourself in the mirror? Kids do. By the way, you find at the bottom of anything that God uses, there's almost always a person or two that say, you know what? I don't know what we can do, but I think we're going to try. God's not limited to say by many or by few. It may be the Lord will work for us. Come on and let us go on. And everything hinges around one guy and his armor bearer. It's where it starts. Let's read this line again. I like this line. Because this is gritty. May I say this? Gene Losey was no superstar. But you had a job to do. He never sat around and whined, complained. All the complaining and whining. He just started thinking and he found a way to do it. Look what it says. In verse, 13. Jonathan climbed up on his hands and upon his feet. And his armor bearer after him. I mean, they're climbing up a place where they're going foot over. I mean, this is rock climbing. And but when they get up on top, it says, and there fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer, slew after him. And the first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men. And all of this whole story revolves around one guy and the guy that worked with him saying, come and let us go over. Godly initiative. In verse 23, we hear, so the Lord saved Israel that day. Later on in the next story, we'll talk about next week. Stupid Saul wants to kill his own son and the people won't let him do it. And the reason the people won't let him do it is the people, they knew what happened. Look at me. They knew what Saul was like. They knew about the people that had gone over to the Philistines. They knew about the people hiding in the hole. They knew about everything. And they knew that one person made a difference. Look at me. There are people in this room that every day just keep plugging away, trying to make a difference. Do you say, does everybody get help? No. But what about deadheads that never do anything, that spend their life being entertained and well-fed? Tomorrow morning, I'll show up in a class. I will not be able to impact every kid in my Bible class, but every one of them I can, I'm going to impact them. You say, why? It's all I can do. Come on, let's charge that hill. Let's climb up that hill. It may be. So at the very end of the story, the battle's over. Why won't they let Saul kill Jonathan? Look what it says. The highlighted part. Well, right before that it says, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day. So how did they win against all odds? By providential events that only God can do, and by one godly man's, look at me, initiative. It would be nice if there were people in this room that would tonight say, I'm going to impact my family. I'm going to help impact some other families. I'm going to talk to some people at work. I'm going to start being salt and light. And through small beginnings, you never know what God will do. It's not about how big we are, how powerful we are. It's about God's providence and our taking the initiative, the bull by the horns. Father, thank you for your word.